to another episode of the Regenerative Health Podcast. I'm Dr. Max Culhane. In this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with Sarah Kleiner. Now, Sarah is a leading quantum health practitioner with over a decade of experience helping her clients optimize their health, and most recently using applied knowledge of circadian and quantum biology. This conversation, we cover a whole range of topics, but ones that I think are most relevant with regard to adding nuance to the dietary-centric debates, leptin resistance, and why this is so important in solving and helping people recover from metabolic diseases, circadian disruption and cancer, and a whole range of other interesting topics. I really enjoyed this conversation because I think it gives this much-needed nuance to a dietary-centric paradigm that can be quite dogmatic at times. If you enjoy this podcast, then I would ask that you leave a review on one of the podcasting platforms. That would be really helpful and it would help reach more people with this message. So thank you very much and on to the show. Okay, I'm joined by Sarah Kleiner. Now, Sarah, I've been trying to get you on the podcast for a very long time and finally the stars have aligned. So welcome onto the show.
Thank you for having me. It's exciting to be here today.
Now, one of the reasons why, or the reason why I wanted to get you on is because I think your journey and your story is so relatable to a lot of people. And the content that you're putting out really speaks from a perspective of having kind of been there and having done that. And, you know, you've obviously mentioned in your previous podcast, journey with weight gain and weight loss, previous struggles with alcohol, previous struggles with fertility. And I think all these are very, very problems that patients that I see are going through. And I guess the solutions that you're proposing and that you've that you offer people and help people with are all coming from a very personal position. So maybe, Sarah, we could start by talking about your journey and how that's led you up to where you are in terms of advocating for the health recommendations that you do.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of didn't really think alternative health, much of alternative health at all until I had my daughter and she had an extreme regression from a flu shot when she was about 12, 13 months. And then all of a sudden I was like, wait a second, you know, what if conventional medicine really is messed up? Like a lot of these people are saying, what if I do need to be worried about, conventional medical practices? Cause I never was that suspicious. I kind of was like, maybe something's not quite right, but I never really, it wasn't personal until that point, until I basically like lost my daughter to, conventional medicine, just trusting the process there. And so that really kind of set me off on a different path of investigating and looking at things different. And I started off myself thinking like vegan would be a really healthy way for me to go. She was never vegan. I actually kind of immediately put her on a specific carbohydrate diet and she mostly ate meat. You know, she grass-fed meat was a big part of her diet and she has this beautifully developed jaw. I mean, she's never had to have braces or dental work because right when she was diagnosed and we started down the journey, I started her, you know, got off gluten and all the processed foods and was the only thing she really would eat for the longest time was grass-fed meat. I would make these meatballs and she just would eat them all the time. So, you know, that kind of started my journey. But for me, I thought vegan was the healthiest thing. I got really into yoga because I needed something for stress relief because I kind of had a nervous breakdown. You can imagine kind of having a normal baby and then everything shifting and changing in your life, the rug kind of get pulling out from underneath you. And so I started down the path of yoga, became a teacher, started doing vegan, and saw my health within a couple. It took a couple of years. At first, I felt good. I was really, you know, like, oh, my weight, I'm so thin. You know, I look so good. You know, we all have this body distortion, a lot of women do. And so I thought because I was so thin that I was healthy. But then things really started getting bad. I started having dental problems. I started getting injured in yoga. Couldn't build muscle. And so finally, after a couple of years and some of my mentors in the yoga community actually convinced me to start eating animal foods again. And so I was, you know, still on this alternative health path. And eventually in 2019, my health was really a mess because stress will do that to you. And, you know, just chronic stress of raising a child with a lot of extra needs, you have to be more cautious with your health. So I was having a lot of like gut issues, skin issues, bloating, IBS, just a lot of stuff, and decided to try the carnivore diet, which immediately pretty much cleared up a lot of the gut issues, the skin issues. I felt great. I thought like, this is the holy grail, you know, this is it. And just kind of dove into the carnivore world. And, you know, fast forward, deciding at the end of 2020, I wanted to get pregnant, and thinking like, I'm definitely very healthy with this carnivore diet. There were a few things that were kind of like frustrating. I had started gaining weight, even though I hadn't really changed what I was eating. I was like, well, you know, I didn't think much of it. I just thought, well, I've gained this 20 pounds. It's not really a big deal. But then I started having miscarriages, and, you know, which is really hard. I think a lot of people don't talk about miscarriage enough, but it's a really devastating thing to go through. Just to, you know, think you're going to have a baby and then you lose the baby. And so that pushed me to investigate further. And so I went down this kind of rabbit hole of functional medicine and, testing and supplements and testing and supplements. And it was very expensive. I didn't really lose a lot of weight. I maybe lost like 6 pounds or something, and, maybe felt a little bit better, and I still was not able to get pregnant. And so I decided to start down the road of IVF, because I just really had this, I want to have a baby. I'm in my 40s, early 40s, and I need to do this now. And so by the time I had started IVF, I was connected with Dr. Cruz, and I was already well into my first round when I was talking with him, and he said, you need to, you know, off camera, he talked to me and he's like, you need to look into leptin. You need to, he really talked to me about light and kind of flipped my brain about everything that I thought with health. It flipped me onto the concept of deuterium and all these supplements I was taking, how those were just loaded with deuterium. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, this is, first of all, everything he's telling me to do is not, doesn't cost me anything. So why not do it? Why not look further into these things? And I did. I kind of just dove into circadian biology, quantum biology, met up with the lovely people at the Quantum Biology Collective, became really good friends with Carrie Bennett, who's been on your show, Dr. Gasvini, Dr. Corey Gasvini. They started helping me. And for free, you know, they were just like, hey, I just want to help you. And I started doing all the quantum things. I started being very strict with my light, strict with non-native EMF. I started cold plunging. I started laying out in the sun. I started doing all these things, red light therapy. And that was September. And then January, I did the 2 rounds of IVF, which were unsuccessful. We are never able to get any healthy embryos. So we never went through transfer, any of that stuff. We never got any healthy embryos. And so I just decided to take some time off and just focus on quantum biology and circadian biology. And that was what I did. Kept learning, studying, which I've continued to do. Just study as much about this as I possibly can, learn as much as I can. And I went to my doctor in January just to kind of get baseline testing. And she was like, well, you know, everything's not quite perfect. So I'll probably see you again in February for IVF. And I thought to myself, no, that's not true. Because I had decided that I was going to use these things to get pregnant. And I did. And I gave birth in October of 2022. So my son is actually going to turn 1 tomorrow. Amazing, healthy. Thank you. Yeah. He's a brilliant, amazing boy, beautiful, healthy. Everything is just wonderful. And yeah, I've continued all the circadian and quantum principles. I still believe that, you know, food is a form of light, and carnivore can be really beautiful and helpful for people, but I'm more in line with like seasonal eating a little bit more and looking at things through the eyes of leptin resistance when it comes to food rather than just like a dogma. And so, yeah, that's, I guess, a long answer to the journey, but I'm very passionate about helping others kind of take some of these more complicated concepts of quantum biology and circadian biology and apply them, especially women, to their hormones, because I've had, you know, lots of women actually get pregnant following this advice. I've also had women in perimenopause who are having very uncomfortable symptoms like hot flashes, and women in menopause as well, hot flashes, insomnia, weight gain, been able to apply these quantum and circadian principles to them and see them lose weight, no longer have hot flashes, just really balance out and feel better. So I'm a big believer in this stuff, big believer.
Yeah. And in my general practice, two of the most common presentations that I see in my female patients are fertility optimization and just stubborn weight loss resistance.
Yes.
And what your story is basically telling us, which I really love, is how you kind of found out for yourself that the advice that you got wasn't working, and that you eventually got to, I guess, the root cause of mm-hmm. how to optimize your fertility. And optimizing your fertility was as a side effect of optimizing your biology. And I like to tell people that, like, if you're thriving and healthy, you will be fertile. You can't disentangle the two of them. So many people, I guess, do get onto this IVF train, and it is a heartbreaking process, because not only the financial cost, but the I guess the feelings evoked of shame or of inadequacy of having failed implantations, or in your case, not even able to get any viable embryos. And I think it's an amazing testament to the practice that you did, that not only that you were able to fall pregnant at the age of 42, I believe, completely mm-hmm. naturally. So, and that's why I was so excited to get you on, because I think your messages resonates with so many people, and particularly women. So explain, maybe from your point of view, what this leptin focused strategy involves, and how is that different and more nuanced than simply the diet or the low carb or the carnivore based kind of approach?
Yeah, absolutely. And I also failed to mention that I lost 30 pounds before I got pregnant. You know, I had talked about that stubborn 20 pounds that I had picked up, you know, seemingly out of nowhere. When I implemented these principles, I lost 30 pounds and then got pregnant, which, you know, I don't want people hyper-focused on losing weight if they're trying to optimize fertility, because you don't want to be underweight. You do want to have, you know, you want to be at a healthy weight to be fertile. It's important. So I don't want people to get hyper-focused on that, but I do love to mention that fact that I didn't track, I didn't over-exercise, I didn't go crazy with the weight stuff, and it just kind of, I lost the weight as a side effect of implementing these things. But essentially, leptin, you know, it's important. It's a signaling, it's a master circadian signaling hormone, and it impacts your thyroid. It impacts insulin. It impacts your sex hormones. It's a master hormone. So it signals all these downstream hormones and impacts them. It even impacts your immune system and bone health, heart health. I mean, there's so many things that we continue to learn about leptin. It wasn't even discovered until 1994. So there's a lot that we're still learning. But essentially, we want really strong circadian rhythms. And that's one of those things that I always thought was just silly. You know, it was like too simple to be true, to go out and look at sunrise every day and to wear blue blockers after dark. And a lot of people dismiss those things and just want to focus on the food. And then they focus on food, and nothing, you know, they get a little result. But then they still have lingering issues, maybe thyroid, weight, you know, it's still like some of it's coming off, but the rest of it just really isn't. And so that circadian practice is absolutely crucial to this whole process. So I'm like, you have to do that first, you know, and that involves sunrise, and then the next window is UVA. And people are like, how long can I spend out, you know, what's the minimum amount of time? And I'm like, you're looking at it all wrong. I get it. I know people are busy. They have busy lives. But if you go into this thinking like, what's the minimum I can do? You know, yeah, I can help you if you have a busy life and a schedule and all that. But I hate when people kind of look at it like, what's the minimum I can do? You know, I make it a game. What's the maximum you can do? How can you shift your life and shift? If you really want to heal, you're going to have to shift and you're going to have to change. And it's a mindset that you're going to have to go into to like, how long can I spend outside in the morning? And so I think that's really, really crucial for people.
Yeah. And look, the way I think about circadian biology, having come from a predominantly dietary focused paradigm, is coming to an understanding that this is basically the master regulation of our biology.
Yes.
And yes. You, it's like if you don't respect circadian biology, you're going to get wrecked. You're going to have a bad time. And just as mm-hmm. if you drove a sports car, you know, off road, if you're not respecting your body's circadian needs, you're going to damage your car. You're not going to be thriving optimally. And this could be a segue into what we talk about next. But I think the effectiveness of really strict carnivore, particularly in my mind, seems to be in some people papering over the cracks of an inadequate light environment. And it really is this idea of if we're not getting our circadian signals timed perfectly or optimally, then our body is going to be not operating, and then therefore something like a carnivore diet is more essential to kind of fill things in. The not to say that it's not effective, and I really liked your conversation that you had with Carrie in August on your Quantum Conversations podcast, which is we really need to separate people. We need to separate a therapeutic effect from a general kind of lifestyle approach. And when I see patients who are extremely leptin resistant, or extremely insulin resistant, or having severely uncontrolled autoimmune disease, then carnivore diet is definitely the first kind of port of call, in addition to these things like circadian biology. But the whole kind of landscape is quite quagmired in dogma, and it really isn't helping when we don't make these nuances that kind of help people to address the things that's going to help them the most.
Yep, I agree. It's a hard conversation to have, and I do think that, you know, if your light environment is not optimized, that it is more important for you to be ketogenic. And we know what happens in the mitochondria when you are ketogenic. You make four times more water, which is, you know, everyone talks ATP, 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 you know, it's the water in your body. And so that is really a driver of energy, coherence, all of that stuff. So I do think that being on a ketogenic carnivore diet can be extremely helpful for people. But, you know, just from where I sit, I work with a ton of people and have a lot of people come through my courses, and I get a lot of people that have done carnivore for a year, a couple of years, and they're not optimized. They're still having all these issues. And so that's where I'm like, all right, well, then we need to really look at the circadian quantum aspect of your life a lot deeper, you know?
Yeah, and a point about leptin as well. And again, it's this hormone that I really loved your way you described it as kind of this master circadian regulator. It is a hormone that's made in our fat tissue, and it informs the body of how much energy is on board. And yeah. When we're talking, when I'm talking about patients and we're doing metabolic disease reversal, because I see patients in my clinic who are coming off insulin, are coming off diabetic medications, using a holistic approach, of which low carb or carnivore is part of that. But we talk about insulin resistance being kind of the first thing that going wrong that precedes the development of type 2 diabetes and heart disease mm-hmm. and all these dementia and fatty liver disease and all the sequelae of metabolic syndrome. But what you're saying, Sarah, and what I guess this literature shows us is that there's going to be dysfunction of leptin and leptin signaling even before your fasting insulin level goes up. So maybe could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, leptin resistance is a precursor to insulin resistance. It happens first. And that's where a lot of people come to me. They're like, I've gone through the testing. I'm not insulin resistant. My blood glucose is not diabetic or even pre-diabetic yet, you know, but I'm having all these symptoms. And the literature is quite extensive around leptin at this point, because like I said, it's been discovered in 1994, but there is a tie with leptin resistance and PCOS, leptin resistance and unexplained infertility, leptin resistance and hot flashes. I mean, so a host of hormone imbalances, you know, which people are usually having these hormone imbalances first. And everyone's like, oh, it's estrogen. Oh, it's progesterone. Oh, it's testosterone. I'm like, yes, but you don't understand. Those are downstream hormones, right? We've got leptin, cortisol, melatonin, these are up at the top, and then everything else is underneath, and thyroid as well. And so if we can optimize leptin, cortisol, melatonin, these three master hormones first, a lot of times these issues with these hormone imbalances, regardless of what it is, they work out. And I think that's, you know, that can be hard for people because they're in this mindset of, you know, I have to do this extensive testing. I have to spend all this money to find out this hormone is low and this hormone is high or this hormone is, you know, and they get all tied up in these numbers. When I like to just, it's a lot more simple and it's a lot cheaper of a route to take to address things in this kind of top-down manner. Because again, like you said, leptin resistance is a precursor to insulin resistance. And there's a ton of literature around insulin resistance as well, especially in regards to hormone imbalances. And so, yeah, if these things are not optimized, then supplementing exogenous hormones, trying to do specific strategies to raise specific hormones and lower other hormones, it's just kind of like you're chasing your tail and it could be a big waste of time. And I know that because that's what I was doing kind of on my fertility journey. It was like, oh, your DHEA is low. Your testosterone's low. This is low. Estrogen's a little bit high. And so I was like, let's take this supplement to bring this up and push this one down. And like I said, I only would get so far. It would help a little bit, but then I still wasn't getting pregnant and the weight wasn't coming off. And it was just like this, you know, this big cycle of spending money and
frustrating.
It was a big waste.
Yeah.
Very frustrating.
And look, I'm always on a quest to find the most preventative health kind of advice. And I always want to be able to offer my patients, what is the most preventative thing that we can do to allow you to live the longest, most healthiest, most fertile, joyful kind of existence? And that taking it back even before insulin resistance, as you said, to leptin, melatonin, cortisol is what I believe the literature shows in terms of what we need to do to really optimize health. And I mean, it's an entire different conversation, but that ties into the mitochondria. But it's about respecting the circadian biology. And the key point here is that we can't optimize leptin, melatonin, cortisol only with food. And I think that is the issue with a food-centric approach to health optimization, is it's simply not it's not getting all the pieces of the puzzle. And as you mentioned at the beginning, leptin is a circadian hormone. Leptin optimized requires an optimal circadian rhythm. And look, again, we haven't even talked about POMC, which is something I guess Dr. Cruz would have talked to you. He talked to me a lot about, but the master orchestration of this whole process, it's called the leptin melanocortin pathway for a reason, is because it goes all the way back to this ancient molecule, this ancient gene product that was, you know, around in lungless fish and, you know, jawless fish 500 million years ago. So I really like to add that kind of ancestral kind of perspective onto this in terms of justifying why we're putting circadian biology kind of at the top of the pyramid.
Absolutely. I 100% agree. And yeah.
The point about leptin, let's talk practical aspects of leptin resistance, because let's say someone is having a lady is having weight loss resistance and mm-hmm. it's the middle of winter. I mean, I don't know what latitude you're at, but in Albury, it's the 36th south latitude. And they're like, oh, you know, I think I'm doing everything healthy. They're waking up at maybe 6 a.m. and they're in the gym. There's all blue light overhead. And they're coming back. They're drinking a smoothie with berries and a bit of banana in it. And they're doing what they think is, well, what they've been told is a kind of a healthy routine. But again, this weight mm-hmm. isn't moving. So how do you think what's going wrong here, and how does that tie into their leptin situation?
Well, I mean, what's really important, again, those master hormones, leptin, cortisol, melatonin. So if it's the middle of winter and she's getting up at 6 a.m. and has blue lights overhead, that's a huge circadian mismatch because the sun comes up a lot later in the winter. And so in the winter time, it's the time to be a bit more restorative with your morning routine. I keep blue blockers beside the bed, especially since I have a baby, you know, and I do have to get up in the night every now and then. So the blue blockers come on. So I'm not exposing my eyes to blue light, because blue light is a huge driver of cortisol, right? Which is a huge driver too much cortisol at the wrong times can be insulinogenic, can drive hormone dysfunction. And so you have to be mindful of that. And women, when they get over a certain age, right, more into that perimenopausal area, you are much more sensitive to cortisol fluctuations. It is much more of an issue. And I just went over this in my group with somebody who was like, I'm starting to have irregular cycles and I'm only 43. What do I do? I'm like, we have to tighten up the game. You know, you can't be spiking your cortisol at 6 a.m. with a bunch of blue lights overhead in the middle of winter, right? You want to start your day off restorative, slowly if you can. Wear the blue blockers. Get the sunlight in your eyes in the morning. And then that UVA window is also crucial for telling your body, like giving your body the correct signals. This is what's important. Like what comes in through your eyes, through that suprachiasmatic nucleus, is going to inform your brain. It's going to inform your body. Let's release these specific hormones at specific times. And it's like this beautiful orchestra that happens. The second thing, so that's my issue with the gym at 6 a.m. and the blue lights overhead, because again, cortisol is supposed to come up gently in the morning and then come to a peak and then start to fall and come down. So it goes in a curve. So people are like, oh, you've got high cortisol. And like, well, what time of day is it? You know, there's a rhythm to our cortisol. It's not just, oh, you got high cortisol. Is it high at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, or is it spiking way too high in the morning, which is with a lot of people skipping breakfast, going to the gym, doing the blue lights, doing the coffee,
drinking coffee,
all of that stuff. Yeah. Yeah. And especially if you're in that more sensitive time frame, you know, in that perimenopausal window, you really have to be more mindful of your morning routine, how you set yourself up for the day, the signals that you're giving your body. And food is a signal as well. So food is a form of light, right? Our food is grown under sunlight. And in the wintertime, for most people, the UV index is a 5 and under, you know, and when the UV index starts to go below a 5, our microbiome changes. So our microbiome shifts in the winter, our hormones shift in the winter. And a lot of us don't respect that in regards to food. Your body is less able to deplete deuterium in the winter, which is another rabbit hole people can go down. But sugar, the fruits, all of those things, number one, the UV light that is needed to grow those foods is not outdoors. It's not outside. So that's an incongruent light signal. And they're very high in deuterium, and your body has less ability to deplete deuterium, which will slow down your mitochondria and speed up aging. And so that's my problem with the fruit smoothies in the wintertime, is that, you know, it's a confusing signal. And for leptin, we need a strong signal of protein and bioavailable protein, in fact. So I'm not talking about tofu or, you know, beans, or you need eggs, meat, wild caught fish. Those things are very, very crucial for that leptin signaling. And so in the morning, you know, ideally in the winter, if you have hormone dysfunction, anyone really, because it'll catch up to you eventually, I would love it if you could wake up restoratively in the winter, wear your blue blockers until the sun comes out, then get that signal of the sunrise, which has the correct amount of blue light. So there's a little bit of blue light, but it's balanced with red and the other colors at sunrise so that your body gets that right signal of like this, make this amount of cortisol. And then you get back out there at UV and UVA and you get that signal to synthesize those hormones. You're making serotonin, which gets synthesized into melatonin for that night. And then you get that the breakfast, the strong protein signal with some fat to balance your blood sugar for the day. That's Carrie and I talk about, you know, we both of us eat a carnivore breakfast regardless of the time of year because it is great for getting your blood sugar balanced and stable for the day. Because how you set yourself up in the morning with your blood sugar, with leptin signaling, all of these things is going to influence your energy and your mood and all of those things for the entire day. So I think that those things are really important if someone has hormone imbalance or just in general, honestly.
Yeah. And I talk to my patients about their food diet and their light diet. And what you said there, Sarah, is how critical the morning routine is for both setting your food diet and your light diet and setting you up for, mm-hmm. for a great day. And I really think women particularly, I mean, everyone, but women particularly are chronically eating insufficient dietary protein and insufficient bioavailable dietary protein, whether they are in childbearing years or later in life. And it has this flow on effect that, you know, young girls are chronically hungry because they're eating, yep. they're eating salads, they're eating the kale smoothie instead of eating, you know, three pasture raised eggs and a slice of, you know, organic halloumi, which is what they should be eating instead. And I think when we flip that paradigm from a dietary point of view, people feel so much better. And if we can add those light signals on additionally, then we're kind of ticking all the boxes for mm-hmm. For optimal health in a morning routine. I want to make a point about cortisol, and I talked to Dr. Sean O'Mara, and he sees a lot of patients with visceral fat, and maybe mm-hmm. a little bit less sorted. And I think that's another key point, that by the time someone's come to see, say, you or Carrie, they're already have high health literacy, they're already highly mm-hmm. motivated, and they might have tried a whole bunch of things. Often the patients that I see in clinic, they're still a lower down on a kind of a health journey. Maybe they're still eating a whole heap of processed foods. But one of the contributors to visceral fat, in addition to the processed food, is high cortisol, is stress, and is mm-hmm. circadian disruption, which is going to be putting their cortisol level up. So, we're talking about a very holistic picture. And when you're getting a correct blue light signal in the form of natural sun in mm-hmm. the morning, which, as you said, is balanced by the infrared, balanced by the red, rather than the LED downlights, which is blue and nothing else, then, you know, we're really doing things better once we're sending those signals. And I also like the point you made about how you routinely eat a carnivore breakfast. And I guess mm-hmm. this is the nuance that I'm trying to communicate, which is it doesn't have to be all or nothing. And mm-hmm. in the extreme carnivore side of things, it's in advocating for kind of meat only, no matter what the season is, no matter who you are.
Yeah.
You know, even if it's an equatorial latitude in the middle of summer, mm-hmm. you know, only eat meat. Well, that's not going to work. And at mm-hmm. the same, at the other side of things, there's this approach of, okay, eat fruit and honey with your carnivore all year mm-hmm. round, even if you're in the most southern latitude, even if you've got metabolic disease, insulin resistance, leptin resistance. Like I feel a little bit frustrated, and you probably do as well, Sarah, because mm-hmm. there's lacking this nuance that I think could help mm-hmm. so many more people if they make these distinctions.
Yeah, I mean, it's so simple, really. And that was what was so empowering to me when I went down this rabbit hole, is like, wait a second, I don't have to subscribe to someone's dogma around food. I just have to follow the laws of nature, right? Like, it's that simple. It's just the laws of nature. And for me, you know, I started implementing local seasonal carbohydrates for the first time when I began my leptin protocol. And it wasn't a lot. It was like 1 or 2 days a week I would cycle them in because I did have a low T3. And I think that that was contributing to the infertility after being carnivore keto for 2 years solid with no breaks. I do think that implementing those local seasonal carbohydrates, just even a couple of days a week is what I did, made a huge difference, right? But then come wintertime, I kind of phase a lot of those out. And if I was doing a carb cycling day, it was like a more cellar stable carbohydrate, like a winter squash or root vegetables, those types of things. And Carrie and I actually just recorded an episode yesterday. I don't know when this will be out, but our Quantum Conversations podcast is all about winter foods and how we approach food differently in the winter than in the summer. And then also how we approach food in the framework of leptin resistance. Because like you said, if someone lives on the equator, but they're leptin resistant, right? They have metabolic dysfunction and they shouldn't be eating the fruit and the honey and the papaya and the mango and all the stuff that grows locally. Even if they're in that environment, if they're leptin resistant, that is the place where we take those foods away until we can correct that metabolic dysfunction. Of course, using a holistic approach that involves your light environment, that involves sun exposure, that involves blocking blue light after dark, getting adequate sleep so your body can undergo autophagy, apoptosis, all those things that are crucial, right? And then once you fix that disruption, once you fix the leptin resistance, then yeah, sure, have the mango, have the things, because you're in an environment with very strong UV light and your body is better able to deplete deuterium in those environments, right? That's, again, it's the laws of nature, that nature is there to support you if you listen. And that barcode of the food makes sense when you're in that environment. But if you're in Canada and it's the middle of winter, you probably don't want to be eating bananas and mangoes and having the tropical fruit smoothies. Like it's kind of comparable to turning on all the overhead lights at midnight. It's kind of doing the same exact thing to your body. So I think that's an important distinction to make for people.
Yeah. And look, I really like to emphasize this idea of eating locally, because you can really solve a lot of the confusion about people like, what should I eat? If you're simply just, okay, take a 50-100 kilometer radius around your house, what would grow at that location, at that latitude, at that season, that is what you can eat. If you are insulin resistant, if you have visceral fat, if you're leptin resistant, if you've got a high fasting insulin, then don't eat a lot of carbohydrates. You know, keep the carbs under 25 grams. And again, that will fluctuate based on the season. But like that is kind of the simplest distillation. And obviously don't eat anything processed. Don't eat processed foods. Don't eat anything from the middle of the supermarket or the middle aisle, anything that came in a packet. But it's a type of nuance that I guess that we're really trying to help people with. You know, should I go all carnivore now? It can get so confusing for people. The other interesting point, and I was listening to a podcast with Dr. Paul Saladino, who I respect immensely, and he was mentioning how he struggled with electrolyte imbalances on carnivore, and I really suspect that maybe he was trying to do carnivore at a higher latitude, you know, maybe it was in the summer. Maybe that was the context of getting those electrolyte disturbances, because he wasn't respecting the circadian timing and the seasonality requirement of what he should be eating.
Yeah, it's, you know, I do think we have a little higher need for electrolytes on a low-carb carnivore diet, for sure, that we have to be more mindful of that. But I don't think it's like an irreparable thing, kind of the way that some people talk about, of like, oh, if you do this diet, you're never going to be able to get your electrolytes in balance. I actually had a horrible time balancing my minerals and kind of keeping things. I felt like I was always chasing minerals on a carnivore diet. And the circadian and quantum principles changed things for me because I began grounding. I began cold therapy. I began sun exposure. I began all of these things that increase cellular hydration. You know, 99%, we're 99% water molecule, our bodies are. And so understanding cellular hydration is a huge piece of this. How high is your non-native EMF exposure? Because we have literature to support that from Dr. Gerald Pollack's lab that shows that non-native EMF dehydrates us on that cellular level 15 to 20%. We see a decrease in cellular hydration. And so the story is not complete if we are just going by this biochemical model of add in this supplement here and add in this mineral here and there, right? It's not a complete story if you're not, as one of my people I love, Dr. Clinton, always talks about tending to your terrain. And I think that part of this story is that we do need to be connected to the earth, gathering those electrons, you know, into the body. That's another way that we can nourish our bodies. And that's where quantum biology comes in, you know, is there's all these processes being performed in the body. It's not this biochemical model that everyone is so obsessed with. There's so many processes in the body that can't be explained through that biochemical model, or it falls short. And so that's where, you know, there's over 1,000 studies on circadian biology in the body, which is very, very, very cutting edge and important for people to understand. But now we've got quantum biology coming up, and there's probably about 300 studies on quantum biology, but it's starting to kind of dive into that piece, I think, for people is important. And it gives them hope, because I get people that are so attached to their labs. They're so attached to these numbers. And, you know, that story I always tell about the month I got pregnant with my son, my doctor, again, she said, yeah, your estrogen's a little bit high, blah, blah, blah. You know, I didn't even listen to it, because she just basically said, this is not going to be optimal for pregnancy. I'll see you next month for IVF. And that wasn't a coherent message to me. My cells did not take that in, and my body did not own that. And I think that we own a lot of our diagnoses. We own the numbers that are on the paper, and we take it in, and the body can shift in this quick manner. It's quantum. It's a very small thing that yields a large result. And I think we have become too reliant on these things, and are and not having faith in the body's ability to heal on this quantum and coherent basis.
Yeah, and I think that the number of circadian biology papers now would be well over 10,000, maybe even over 100,000. And the 2017 Nobel Prize in Medicine Physiology was awarded for the molecular mechanisms of underlying circadian biology. Mind you, I mean, that's another whole discussion about the prestige and validity of the Nobel Prize. We won't open that can of worms. But suffice to say, circadian biology is very, very well it's been explored and developed.
Established,
that's the right, correct word, in the medical and scientific literature.
Although a lot of medical doctors are still not taking it in and applying it, which is, it just shows where we are. It just shows where we are, that the medical community is not taking this into account. And even functional medicine, which is supposed to be better than allopathic medicine, I think it's, my word for it is dysfunctional medicine, because I honestly have come to the conclusion that it's no better than allopathic medicine in many regards, and it's more expensive, and it makes people more anxious and more upset. And it's still following this biochemical model. But even the functional medicine doctors, I would say 90%, at least maybe even more, they don't ever mention the circadian aspect of things at all.
Yeah. And functional medicine is more of a thing over there in the US than it is here in Australia. But essentially being caught up in, I guess, different types of diagnoses, and then different investigations, often involving expensive labs, and then different types of prescriptions. They're still, you know, we talk about
statins. They're still drugs.
Statin is a lifelong medication that, you know, people have been put on for primary prevention of cardiovascular disease to treat, isolated high LDL. without atherogenic dyslipidemia. And, you know, that's a lifelong prescription. But, you know, in some of these prescriptions that people get for natural health supplements from a functional medicine doctor, it just is probably more expensive. And
a lot of them can act as suppressive therapies. You know, that's the big issue. I'm doing Dr. Cowan's new biology clinic certification right now. And, you know, a lot of medicine is suppressing, and it doesn't get to the root cause. You know, you ask a rheumatologist, how many people have you actually cleared or cured? None. I mean, I don't see people being cured of these things, but they're getting steroids and things to suppress the symptoms, which kind of pushes them down further into the body. And it's, yeah.
Yeah. And look, let me make a really clear distinction for my listeners, because what I think the difference is when we have chronic conditions, the allopathic or the traditional Western medical system is geared to simply disease manage. That involves long-term medications and immunosuppressants or, you know, antihypertensives or oral hypoglycemics that aren't solving the root cause of the problem. But if you are in acute trauma, I mean, I worked in the emergency department for 4 years, you know, if you come in diabetic ketoacidosis and your pH is 6.8 and your, you know, GCS is, you know, 6, then, you know, there's obviously a place for it. So let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. I really, agree. Again, this conversation is about nuance. So the nuance here is that we want to get to the root cause of chronic problems that are preventing people from thriving. But if you're having a chronic issue, acute issue, then obviously that needs an acute solution. I really want you to talk about this idea of cellular hydration, and this again, I want to anchor it in biology and science, because what you'll talk about is a mitochondrial issue, and this idea that the mitochondria are not only making ATP, but a byproduct of their function is cellular water, or mitochondrial water. And if we go back to what Dr. Doug Wallace has talked about, which is that the etiology of modern diseases like cancer, like metabolic disease, like neurodegenerative diseases, they're a mitochondrial problem. They're not able to be singled out in most cases to a monogenic condition. It's not a singular nuclear genome problem is why someone gets Parkinson's disease. But so when we understand that there's mitochondrial dysfunction at play, and that is because there's a breakdown in often the electron transport chain, then that is an onus on us to understand how we can optimize our mitochondrial function. So I think that is a good segue into you explaining, Sarah, what is the mitochondrial water? What is cellular hydration?
Right. Well, we make the mitochondria make water at step 4. And that water, again, is crucial for coherence and communication in the body. You know, if 99% of our body is water molecule. And so that's how I look at things on a very simple level, because I have dear friends like Carrie Bennett and Dr. Jalal Khan and Dr. Sarah Pugh that they can really just dive into like the nuts and bolts of how this works. But I just like to keep it a very broad view for people they can just understand this and kind of take it in and apply it to their life. So again, just understanding how much of the body is made of this cellular water, and it's crucial for communication. We think, you know, this organ system, that organ system, everything is connected on this level of coherence and quantum communication. And so looking at our lifestyle, what depletes that cellular water, and then how can we build that up, you know, and things like grounding, UV light, infrared light, having strong circadian rhythms, lowering our exposure to non-native EMF, or maybe getting into some biogeometry, which is another topic Carrie and I are going to be talking about soon on our podcast, to help harmonize some of these things, because it's very difficult to, I think, escape entirely from non-native EMF. But these things are crucial to our health because, again, these organ systems communicate with one another. And you can look at, again, Dr. Pollack's work, Dr. Tom Cowan. He has a book called Cancer and the New Biology of Water. There's a lot of people doing really amazing work to talk about things like cancers and metabolic disease and how this metabolic water in the body is connected and how a lot of disease begins with dehydration, how a lot of dysfunction begins with this loss of cellular water, this loss of communication. And so just on a broad level, that's just how I look at things for people is like, how are your circadian rhythms? How's your exposure to infrared light? What are you doing to build up this cellular water? Are you grounding? Are you touching the earth? Are you outdoors? Or are you stuck inside under artificial lights all day, which is very dehydrating? Are you around non-native EMF all day, which is very dehydrating? All of those things. So I just keep it simple for people.
Yeah, and look, we've got this colony of mitochondria that are essentially ancient bacteria that yes. became endosymbiotic, you know, billion years ago, and now serve us and allow us to live by producing all this energy for us. But as you mentioned, if we don't respect them and if we don't give them an environment to thrive by putting ourselves in a circadianly inappropriate environment, by exposing ourselves to radiation that isn't of the type we evolved next to, if we disconnect ourselves from the negative charge of the earth which we evolved next to, then you know we're going to get sick. And I really agree with you, Sarah, that I like to keep it kind of high level and really simple. All that you're advocating for and I'm advocating for is really helping people get back to what would be an ancestrally appropriate environment. And I think our job is holistic clinicians is really giving our patients tools to mitigate this modern world. Society's invented all these ways of making our lives more convenient, easier to communicate, all these things that we kind of were very grateful for, but they have meaningfully negative effects, side effects on our biology. And I think that is what we're trying to help people with. The last idea that I'd really like to get your thoughts on is for women particularly, and some of the tools that can be really helpful, like fasting or cold exposure, might mm-hmm. require a bit of nuance when applied yes. to women. So maybe you could explain a couple of those nuances for people. Like, oh, I really want to try fasting. I was told this was a good idea, but you know, how should they approach it?
Yes, nuance is a big word here and very, very key for people to understand that if they do want to do some of these things like fasting and cold therapy for women, you do have to be a bit more cautious. Now, I'll talk about fasting first. I don't want people fasting and I don't like it until they've really fixed this leptin signaling issue because you can kind of further throw that off if you are trying to reset your leptin and then you start doing a bunch of fasting, it can just kind of really, really muck things up. And so what I like people to do is give things at least 6 to 8 weeks before they start skipping dinner, which is how I like everyone to fast, even men too, because we have this whole like you have to skip breakfast to intermittent fast and da-da-da and have the coffee for breakfast. And that's a huge issue for leptin, right? You're not getting that strong signal in the morning. And your cortisol is going way higher than it needs to go. And that can create dysfunction later on in the day with these rhythms. So again, the breakfast is crucial. And then once you kind of get past that initial 8 weeks and your sleep is good. So it's really important that your sleep has been optimized before you start throwing out the dinner. So I like that, you know, sleep is optimized. All right, I'm going to skip dinner and I'm not going to do it every day. So that's the thing with fasting is that you don't want to do fasting every single day. You don't want to skip dinner every single day or skip lunch and dinner every single day. You do it maybe a couple days a week, see how your system responds. Is your sleep disrupted? Is your energy disrupted or do you feel better, right? So you have to kind of, it's a hormetic stress, so it's a stressor, but it can be really good, again, to encourage things like autophagy and apoptosis and really can help you become more metabolically flexible, which is what we want to do. Because a lot of people will come to my 21-day leptin program. Some of them can't go longer than 3 hours without eating. So if I tell them to start skipping dinner and fasting, it's going to completely throw things off and they're going to feel terrible, right? So I want people to kind of approach this gently. So we don't create more hormonal disruption. But as far as fasting goes, that's the way I like to do it, is get a good 8 weeks under your belt of getting that really good leptin signaling. At that point, you're really able to just eat three meals a day with no snacks. You know, you're really starting to become more fat adapted. Then boom, you can take away dinner a couple days a week. You may be able to do a 24-hour fast where it's a breakfast to breakfast fast. So that's how I do fasting. I don't make people push into 48-hour and 72-hour fasts often, unless they're maybe dealing with like cancer or serious metabolic issues, then maybe we do that quarterly. It's all on a case-by-case basis. But a lot of people assume I'm anti-fasting. I'm definitely not anti-fasting. I think there's a lot of wonderful benefits to it, but you got to do it with respect for your hormones and where you're at with leptin. I also don't like women, even menopausal, I still like women to kind of follow a moon cycle, even if they don't have a monthly cycle, because that infradian rhythm is still there, even if you're not cycling regularly. So I kind of help women to find, you know, this is my rhythm with the full moon or the new moon. We use kind of the day that they feel their best, you know, I'm like, that's probably your ovulation date. And so we'll kind of follow a new or a full moon cycle. If you're in that last half of your last part of your cycle, you know, like the days 21 through 28, I don't push in fasting during that time. And you can push in a little bit more fasting the beginning of the cycle. So again, all on a case-by-case basis. If you start having sleep disruptions, that's the number one signal that you're pushing things too far with the fasting. So that's how I looked at the fasting.
Yeah, I love it. And I love the point you made that metabolic flexibility is the goal. And
yes,
the majority of people eating a standard Australian diet or a standard American diet, well, a standard American or Australian existence, which I think includes, is implicit in that, is their light environment and their light diet. Mm-hmm. They are not metabolically flexible at all, and they're mm-hmm. stuck in this constant state of you know, glucose fed. And carb consumption, mm-hmm. you know, with more than 400 a day and all kinds of disrupted circadian signals. The other question that I was going to get your take on is cold exposure, because mm-hmm. and cold is something that I mean, there's again a lot of nuance in it, but it can be an incredibly powerful tool to help people get rid of visceral fat and kind of optimize mm-hmm. themselves, especially if they're not living in a latitude with a high amount of UV and solar yield.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's very powerful. And I think it was absolutely crucial for me to getting pregnant because of what it does to, again, the electron transport chain. It kind of shrinks the space between those respiratory proteins, so electrons can tunnel much more efficiently. In other words, it improves your mitochondrial function. And we look at infertility, again, metabolic diseases, all of those things. As you said, with Dr. Doug Wallace's research, it shows us that these are happening because there's an issue of mitochondrial efficiency. And so what cold therapy actually does is it, you know, respiratory proteins kind of brings them back together so those electrons can tunnel a lot quicker. It's just phenomenal for that. And so for me, I kind of had to learn the hard way that it's not, more is not better with cold therapy, especially for women, because when I first started it, I loved it. You know, I wanted to do more because it felt so good. You know, so I have women first start off with a face dunk or even a wrist dunk, and you have to go into this slowly. You don't want to push yourself too far, too fast. And then anything colder than your body temperature is cold therapy. And so when I first started the tank, I bought like a cheap tub off of Amazon and just filled it up with the hose water. I bought a filter from a company called Crystal Quest, no affiliation, but they have like this bathtub filter, like a ball. And so I attached that onto my hose, ran that into a cheap Amazon tub. And then I went to the grocery store and bought a bunch of ice and dumped it in there. And I started with like 60 degrees Fahrenheit. I'm terrible with Celsius. Like I'm still haven't figured out that conversion yet. But that's where I started, with about 60 degrees Fahrenheit, and slowly worked down, right? To get to 32 degrees. Where I made the mistake was, oh, this feels great. So I should do it twice a day. I should do it for 15 minutes. I should do it for 20 minutes. And what I found through trial and error is that about three times a week for 3 to 5 minutes was plenty. And then that week before the cycle, again, like days 21 through 28, listen, if you wake up that morning and your body is like, please don't take me near that cold tub, listen to that, right? Because we, with cold therapy, there is a certain amount of mental toughness that you have to develop, and overriding those feelings of fear and doubt, and you do have to pull up that mental resilience to do it, to get in that cold water, especially in the wintertime. But I say don't override that in days 21 through 28 for women, because your body is a lot more sensitive at that time. So yeah, for me, when I tried to override it, then my cycle ended up being like 7 days late, and the sleep, my HRV was lower, I noticed, and things like that. And so, yeah, I find that with women, you know, respecting the hormonal fluctuations, knowing that more is not better. I think 3 days a week for most people is plenty, for women especially. There's no need to do more than that. And then don't do it directly after like strength training if your muscles are super sore. Do the cold and then do your strength training, because that can also slow down the repair of your body and create more issues. And so, yeah, I have a whole cold therapy course for people who are like wanting to get into it, where I walk them through it and help them get into it gradually. But I think it's wonderful. It's magical. People should be doing it if they are wanting to improve their health or lose weight. Dr. Sarah Pugh just did a great 15-minute video on cold therapy and how it can like kill fat cells, you know, which have this ability to live on forever. Even if we've lost the weight, they just kind of shrink. And so the cold can actually just obliterate those. She talks about the science behind that. So it's great for a host of things, but more is not better.
Yeah. Yeah. And look, we're tempted, especially, you know, those of us who get really into the health side of things, to take mm-hmm. it to the nth degree. But it's great advice to really be listening to your body. And I like the point that you're making, which is for women particularly, respect the cyclic nature of your mm-hmm. biology, which is mm-hmm. during that second half of your cycle, you have to be compassionate to yourself and look after yourself. And maybe it's probably the first half of your cycle that is more appropriate to do a stricter low carb or carnivore, mm-hmm. Do a bit mm-hmm. of fasting, do a bit of cold exposure mm-hmm. on those first 2 weeks, and the second 2 weeks. And maybe it's more appropriate to cycle some carbs if you're leptin and insulin sensitive and you don't have visceral fat. And again, just look after yourself a bit more, and I guess make that nuance and that distinction. And I guess you talked to it a little bit before, but I guess this idea of circadian meal timing mm-hmm. and there's kind of layers. Again, this is the kind of theme of the podcast, is nuance, but it's not only what we eat, but it's kind of when we eat it. Mm-hmm. And this idea that if we're doing a time-restricted eat, it's better to avoid that dinner time and have a mm-hmm. longer period of nothing in your tummy before you try and fall asleep, rather than doing it in the morning. What do you tell patients in terms of the timing of their meals and why they should be considering circadian meal timing?
Yeah, because food is a Zeitgeber, right? It's a secondary circadian signal, and that's very, very well established in the literature also. And so, you know, that's why the breakfast is important, because a lot of people have poor circadian health. And so it kind of reinforces that, you know, you get the sunlight and you get the signal of the protein in the morning. Very good for leptin, very good for cortisol, for those kind of master hormones. And then at night, in the evening, sun goes down, we want cortisol going down, we want to start melatonin production. That's what happens after sunset. And so that's why I encourage people, even if you're not skipping dinner, have your last meal before sunset, or at least 4 hours away from bed, because I know some people that they're not fat adapted. And the sun goes down at 4 p.m. for some people, and they're like, I can't do that. And I'm like, okay, well, work on getting more fat adapted, but 4 hours away from bedtime, because at night, again, we want cortisol and melatonin oppose one another. When you eat, you do elicit a little bit of a cortisol response, which is not a, it's not a bad thing. Like we cortisol bad, this, you know, it's not, it doesn't work that way, but we don't want to be raising cortisol, raising insulin close to bed because we want melatonin, which is this master antioxidant hormone that comes in to be able to really do its job when we're sleeping. You know, melatonin is implicated in, I mean, we talk, there's Russell Ryder is a melatonin researcher, has got amazing, amazing information on melatonin.
The Pope of melatonin.
Yes, exactly. And he does talk about some supplementation, which, you know, I used to be staunchly against, but I'm not 100% opposed to it if someone is like got cancer, for doing it in a very, very small dose with a practitioner, with again, nuance. The everyday person, please optimize your circadian rhythms. Please optimize this meal timing and these other things first, because a lot of the, Carrie and I were talking about this, a lot of the research done with these supplements, people, we don't know that their circadian health, chances are very high, their circadian health was not optimized. Their meal timing was not optimized, all of that stuff. And so I think there can be some value in the research, but we, again, all the factors are not optimized. And so I think that people with the meal timing, going back to that, that's why we want to have the dinner or skip the dinner instead of the breakfast, because we really want to optimize melatonin and, again, autophagy and apoptosis. Cancer happens essentially because a cell has chosen to have an eternal life and continue to, you know, divide and, you know, and that's where the cancer comes from, is because the people are not getting these processes that melatonin helps to facilitate. And so that's why I'm such a stickler for these meal times at specific times. And then when you are implementing fasting, to skip the dinner, because you're going to get a much more powerful result, and the anti-aging benefits and the anti-cancer metabolic, then all that stuff is going to happen when you're skipping the dinner instead of the breakfast.
Yeah, no, I love it. And there's a couple points that I'll make to that, is for, especially for the doctors in the audience. You mentioned Zeitgeibers, and we know from studies in intensive care units that the outcomes of patients who lack Zeitgeibers, like light signals, they have a poorer outcome, because their circadian biology isn't being respected. And we have clocks basically in all our organs that are, as you mentioned, a secondary circadian entrainments that again all connect up to that suprachiasmatic nucleus in the brain, which help us regulate our circadian rhythm. So I would really invite the clinicians and the scientists in the audience to go into the literature and read the papers that exist there. That will really give you more confidence in implementing or recommending these behavioral practices that are so readily backed up by scientific literature, but simply haven't been translated into practice yet. The point about melatonin, I really like to explain that. And, you know, eventually we'll be telling people that you've got to turn your blue lights off because they're a cancer hazard. And people be like, oh, what? How is that the case? And you, as you just explained, Sarah, is when you have those lights on, you're for that, whatever, 400. Melatonin. You can't make melatonin. You're stimulating your melanopsin in your retinal ganglion, your intrinsic photosensitive retinal ganglion cells, the special cells in your eye. You're stimulating them, and you're turning off your anti-cancer master hormone, which is melatonin. So that is the mechanism, that is the pathway, and that is what's borne out in the long-term epidemiological literature with sleep disturbance and shift work, and that relationship to increasing incidence and of various cancers. So I like really laying that out for people, because it gives a more visceral and understandable link between leaving their LED down lights on when they get home at 8 p.m. after a shift of work, and then, you know, a cancer diagnosis. Because it's heartbreaking when someone gets a diagnosis of cancer, and I really feel like people feel very unempowered in that, like, how did this happen to me? And there's so many things from a food point of view, the processed foods, the sugar, the everything like that, but also from a light point of view, there's so many things that we can optimize to help reduce that likelihood of something happening. Do you have any specific thoughts on do you want to add on that?
Well, there's a woman in my leptin group. So when you do my leptin course, I give a month in my private group, and then you can stay on if you want to after that first month. And she's just really inspired me. She was diagnosed with multiple myeloma, and she's really tried everything to help herself. And she found my leptin program probably about 6 months ago and has been very strict about implementing it. And she's had some amazing results as far as seeing blood markers that she's been trying to improve. And multiple myeloma is a blood cancer. She's seen from the sunlight protocol markers of inflammation and things just go down. And her doctors are like, what the heck are you doing? You know, and it's all the things that we've been talking about. And she runs, and I have given her permission to teach and share my information that she's taken from my courses. I'm like, just take it, share it. And she runs a few cancer groups, like Facebook groups, and she's been sharing testimonials with me. It's very touching. I mean, I almost get emotional to think of these people's lives being changed that are doing these really, really simple, fundamental things and seeing results with cancer, you know, and it is a scary diagnosis. My mother was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma when I was 18. And it's scary when you yourself or a family member gets a cancer diagnosis and it's on the rise. And so kind of when you understand this whole melatonin thing and the whole story with light, I think it's empowering. But also, you know, you want to share it with people and you want to get this information out because we are seeing so much more cancer and everyone points to the food. Yeah. Food is a form of light. So yes, I agree that this crappy, and it's high in deuterium. All these processed foods are high in deuterium, which is a known, you know, correlation with cancers, high deuterium levels. Lots of diseases are correlated with high deuterium, but you know, your circadian rhythms, your body's ability to make melatonin at night to perform these processes, I think is crucial, and it's free. You know, it's not a supplement protocol or anything special that you have to really go out and buy, except save a pair of blue blockers. You know, and you get, if you want to just go cheap, get Spectra 479s. I think you get those on Amazon. They're not attractive, but they work. They do the job. So if you are skeptical and you just want to get a cheap pair, get those. And that's, I mean, could really, really change your life, you know?
Yeah. And again, the mainstream is coming around to this idea of cancer as a mitochondrial metabolic disease. And yes, the work of Dr. Thomas Seyfried particularly is really emphasizing this. And again, they're kind of looking at mitochondrial optimization basically from a low-carb ketogenic point of view, which is good. Mm-hmm. But again, that's not the whole story. It's not the whole story. Right. As anyone who's listened to this and your work, is what we're saying is that if you want to go the whole hog, if you want to do the whole process of looking after your colony of mitochondria and thereby reducing the likelihood of developing mitochondrial cancer, which is a mitochondrial disease, then you have to add in the light and the circadian biology and kind of everything that we've talked about. And look, it's an incredibly touchy and fraught kind of area, which mm-hmm. is non-conventional or adjunctive treatments to cancer. You know, the oncology is there's very definitive protocols and even more so than any other aspect of medicine, is that stepping outside of those protocols is mm-hmm. can be really alienating for patients because there's no one to support them. And I'm definitely not advocating that people go on and not listen to their oncologists. And I would just make the point that what you've talked about, Sarah, is that you can help people in a way that doesn't involve, you know, using coffee enemas or any kind of mm-hmm. you know, anything that's precluding them from also doing their conventional treatment. So it's just amazing that people can implement what you're recommending and get such an amazing outcome
Yeah. Like we said earlier, I think that there can be a place for conventional medicine, and the people sometimes are going to need this. Dr. Clinton, I was talking with her on my podcast recently, and she struggled with a lot of autoimmune conditions. And she said for a bit of time, she did have to use steroids, and they saved her and they helped her. But she was able to implement these strategies with quantum biology and circadian biology and not utilize steroids in the long term. So I think I want to take away, if someone is feeling shame over needing a medication or relying on these things, I think there's a place for them for some people, but we just want to know that these things can be used in conjunction with and perhaps can help you move away from that suppressive medical model at the end of the day.
Yeah, 100%. And look, I'm a general practice doctor, and of course I'm going to be prescribing you medication. And most commonly, people aren't interested in making any lifestyle changes. And
right.
Then I'll be the first one to, you know, get out my prescription pad. But and I'm never going to dissuade someone or not inform them of a medication option. I see it as my job is just simply giving people options and giving them all the information so that they can make the most informed decision. Because at the end of the day, this is about people. This is about our patients, our clients, and about doing the best thing by them. And it's not going to help anyone by refusing to give everyone the option. That's not how medicine works. That's not informed care. And I think that's how people get alienated from practitioners and from systems as a whole, mm-hmm. is when they feel like their needs aren't being met or they're not being listened to. So, I mean, it's amazing what you're doing, Sarah. And I think your ability to reach people in the way that you are, I'm thinking about the average colleague in kind of my profession who are well-meaning, but the amount of benefit and change and help that you're offering them from your strategies is just incredible. And I'm really glad that you're offering this to people and really helping them in that way. So maybe do you have any kind of final parting thoughts or comments that you want to share with the listeners?
Yeah, I mean, I think just keep it simple and try not to worry about doing absolutely everything all at the same time. Just try to improve a little bit every day. You know, if it starts with just sunrise, right? If it just starts with morning light and trying to make it so that you're able to catch those things, I think that's going to be helpful. And because I think people hear these types of conversations and they get overwhelmed. So for me, it was gradual. You know, I didn't change everything all in one day. It came in layers, and you just try a little bit more every day, and don't get discouraged if you can't do it all perfectly. Your body is, you know, and people are like, oh, my husband turned the overhead lights on, and stress can actually cause a great deal of mitochondrial dysfunction and dysfunction and incoherence in the body as well. And so I think we have to take that into account as well of the, you know, that sort of thing. And so just go slowly. And if you change one thing, start with your morning routine with that protein and fat for breakfast and the sunrise and the UVA light. See how that shifts things for you. And if it is a positive shift, which I think it will be for the majority of people, then you know, maybe get a pair of blue blockers and start with sunset comes on, pop those things on. And even if you still watch the TV, which I don't advocate for, but even if you still watch TV and you've got blue blockers on, I'm going to wager that you're going to feel some improvements in your sleep as well. So just do what you can and take it piece by piece.
Great. Love it. Thanks so much for your time, Sarah. Where can people follow your work and find out more about what you're doing?
My website is www.sarahkleinerwellness.com. And then I'm on Instagram as @sarahkleinerwellness. And I'll send you some links to put in the show notes for some of my free guides. I've got a 12-page, I call it a guide, but it's really kind of an ebook. It's like a 12-page guide to building your perfect quantum day and, you know, how to kind of put these routines into place. I've got a guide to using blue blockers, and I've got all kinds of free content for people who are not quite ready to invest in a course. So I'll give you some of those links. And then I do have courses as well. My 21-day course, which is kind of the flagship course. And then I have a lot of other little small courses like cold therapy and, you know, metabolic reset, things like that, that people can keep diving deeper into if they want to learn more about these things.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time, Sarah. And we'll definitely include all that information in the show notes.
Thank you for having me. Cool.
Thanks for listening to the Regenerative Health Podcast. I hope this episode helped you better understand some aspect of improving your lifestyle for optimal health. If you enjoyed this episode, then share it out with friends and family. Leaving a 5-star review on Apple or Spotify podcasts also helps spread the message. Thank you and see you next time.